Let's see. I have left out some futzing around in chapter 10, which...
That came out in December of 1968.
Yeah. How's that involved? I met a few people in this department that had been involved with chapter 10. Hans Schneider being the principal one, because he was on some committee that had to do with that. And that, of course, had had to confront the sort of student power issue. And in fact, chapter 10 did wind up being a definite assertion of faculty power, which there hadn't been up to that moment with regard to TAs. And TAs, of course, disliked that very much and said that's a very retrogressive step. Actually, I wrote the essentially the form of words that's in chapter 10.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Hans was going off to these meetings and coming back and talking about it with me. I forget. He was then 68, 66, 67, 67, 8. He was chairman. And I was associate chairman. But in any event, we'd certainly gotten in the habit of talking a great deal together due to that relationship. So he was talking to me about chapter 10, too. And they did come to this question, what is going to be said on this issue? And there was a lot of hand-wringing and going around in circles, finding great difficulty in saying anything that they really want, you know, finding anything that reflected what they wanted to do and that they could, you know, agree on language on. And I, for one, said, grasp the nettle. It's got to be done sooner or later. Do it now and get it in there. And for instance, you could put it this way, and gave them a piece of paper. And, that is more or less the way it finally came out. The committee as a whole decided that was the thing to do. Of course, so there were a few people, I now forget who they were, who had been interested in how that fared, and were therefore interested in, as bargaining got set up, because there was in the structure agreements this very large joker, the educational planning business. Since nobody knew where that came from, nobody had known anything about the negotiations which led to the structure agreements. I'm not sure that, you know, we may not have first seen the structure agreement when TA shoved it under our nose. We didn't have the feeling, well, that's an ambiguous form of words which we can make mean what we want. So we had a feeling that's an ambiguous form of words which is a large potential threat. And maybe that really means that tomorrow TAs are going to run the whole math departments. This, again, was a small group of people who were attuned to this particular issue.
Who? What was the group?
Well, I can't remember. It certainly had no existence. Didn't, you know, get together for lunch on stated occasions or anything like that.
This is not just math department.
Well, I'm now speaking of people in the math departments. Once this chapter 10 business was done, weren't rushing around and talking to colleagues in other departments about the student power issue. Math has always been a sort of Robinson Crusoe among departments living on its little desert island. Individuals will get involved with some committee confronting a campus issue, and while they're doing that, these are math department individuals, why they will be conferring with colleagues in other departments, perhaps rushing back, you know, and talking to people in the math department about, we just did this in committee, what do you think of it? And then the committee goes away, and 99% of all that contact with other departments vanishes concurrently. For better or for worse, that has been our way we've lived. So we're actually changing now, but
it's getting less likely.
Yeah, the math department feels it is more important to be more involved with the rest of the university. but
rest of LNS, or I mean, I should imagine.
Well, not necessarily. And we have many national involvements with College of Engineering.
Yeah, well, I would think so already.
In some ways, you know, every student in the College of Engineering takes a sequence of math courses. Many students in the College of Letters and Science don't take any math
courses.
That's
why I was feeling that you might feel more isolated from LNS than you would from other sections
of
the university.
We are, I guess, in many ways, a slight anomaly. And I used to go to meetings of the research committee, and when I listened to the people in the physical sciences talk about, you know, what they needed research-wise, it seemed to me quite clear that math was had to be the complement of physical sciences, because they're so involved with these machines, and a whole lot flows from that, and we aren't. And I would say, well, obviously we aren't them. And then I'd go along and listen to people in the humanities talk, and my naive and unfair impression of the kinds of questions that are of interest to humanities are exactly questions which are intrinsically capable of being answered, because that way you can keep the discussion going forever. And then I would feel, well, we certainly must be scientists, because mathematicians like to pose questions sharply in a form which they can be answered and get an answer and move on. Actually, I say I'm being unfair to the humanities. I may be somewhat not putting it in exactly the right form, but it's a very real and very evident difference when you're dealing with these groups. Mathematicians, you know, like to have an agenda and proceed from point to point and say our decision should be based on these factors, and we have measured these factors, and they are such, and therefore we deduce, you know, the answer is. Other people, you know, that whole idea seems plain crazy to them. It's a way of doing your business. I think, you know, if anything, you know, it's at best ludicrous.
But still, math is one of it. One of the humanities. This is amusing, because I was looking in the chapter of a recent sort of history of the university on LNS, and they didn't mention the math department. They had humanities, the biological sciences, the physics. And
uh-huh.
I looked, where had they put the math department? Nowhere.
Right.
It fits what you're saying.
It has a humanistic component, and yet it is. If it is attached to the humanities, it's somewhere out on the periphery rather than in the middle. It's, it doesn't share all the stigmata of other humanities. So as I say, you know, it's intellectually a somewhat anomalous discipline. And, that, I suppose, again, may be a reason for this Robinson Crusoe business. That's I just said that, yeah, I would go to these meetings, and whichever, in the research committee, in whichever meeting I was at, I would feel I was at the wrong meeting.
Yeah.
That perhaps, you know, there is in there something about mathematicians. If I felt that way on both sides, I must have been half right both sides, but I was saying half wrong both sides rather than half right. Perhaps mathematicians feel that things ought to equate fully rather than just partially. But, anyway, I'm saying that a few people were interested in the start of bargaining because a feeling that the student power issue was a real issue, which is going to be important, and then going on to explain that this didn't constitute a group which had a group existence. They were just, you know, people that were interested in this one issue, and if they would bump into one another, might they say, how's student power going, or, you know, some...
But who were they? Could...
Well, they're certainly me, not Schneider. Who else? I suppose the... I guess John Well must have been then chairman, and he was certainly interested. Of course, you know, he had to be interested, because he was a chairman.
Anatole Beck or Mike Beecher?
Well, these were certainly people who were interested in TAA, though not exactly on that issue. Actually, neither Anatole Becht nor Mike Bleacher is as favorably disposed towards student power as some other people. At that time, I remember thinking that many discussions were fruitless because they were phrased in terms of liberal and conservative, and that the proper characterization in confronting TAA was hard versus soft. Hard being people that really like to think things through, decide what they want, and go out and try and get it, and soft being people that don't, that like to go through life being as agreeable as possible and hoping that everything will pan out. And Anatole Becht is certainly on that scale a hard person rather than a soft person. Mike Bleacher is on that scale more toward the hard side than the soft side. And the people that are most receptive to the student power message are the soft type of people, who, as I say, want to be agreeable to the students, mm-hmm. and if the students want to talk, why dandy, why don't they all talk? Mm-hmm. And they're able to imagine this as being devoid of implication. Whereas people who think things through, and decide what they want, see that there's a little aspect of what mathematicians call a zero-sum game to all of this. To a certain extent, more student power means less faculty power, and one can then get into exciting arguments about, well, how about the administration? They have a share of power. And, they could contribute something to this game, and perhaps if we enlarge the scope of the issues, we don't have to be in head-on conflict. But nonetheless, if you really think about what you want, then you are have it in mind that more student power may well mean less faculty power.
I would guess that somebody like Hank Hasek would prefer your type of approach to the thing. Many of the TAs have said that the ones whom they
who they
like to know where people stood, and they themselves had something quite specific in mind.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just a nice talk with a faculty member.
That's certainly what TAs were saying at the time. I think that present in their minds were two considerations. To a certain extent, yes, they liked this the hard types from a naive point of view. They could talk to them, they knew where they stood, and of course there are all kinds of difficulties with faculty, from a student's point of view, with faculty's desire to be agreeable, and this something that I think was more true before the union than afterwards, that the faculty would be agreeable about, when talking to the TA, about all the things that were going to happen in the TA's future. Actually, really, it's not the TA so much, the graduate students. Back when we talked to the graduate students, oh, yes, you're doing fine, I think the world of you, and then would go and write a letter of recommendation saying, frankly, this is a mediocre student, or, the disparity in the math department I don't think was quite as great as I've suggested, but there would be nonetheless a disparity between what the graduate student might suppose from talking with a faculty member and what the faculty member would say when the student's out of the room. Mm. And so they naively had a reason to like people that they felt were saying the same thing whether or not the student was present. And, of course, also, I think TAs, who were themselves hard types and trying to do something here, had a feeling that it was a little easier, might well be easier, to deal with, to get something, if they could map more faculty people onto a hard position, and then, by gosh, they could have a confrontation and see what they got, whereas With these soft types, you know, you just, it was like pushing marshmallows. Never seemed to get anywhere. Events didn't have consequences. This hard type person, if you all the pieces are linked up, and you push here, and if you push hard enough, something will move over there. And the soft person, you push in a little bit here, but that isn't really what you wanted anyway. And globally, nothing's accomplished.
Of course, the contractor gets rid of the soft person, doesn't it? I mean, that has
that's one of the points of it, is to make some things be settled in a hard fashion. That's one of the reasons why faculty members today would by and large be very happy to hear the TA had gone away and the contract had gone away and that nothing had to be settled in a hard fashion anymore. Because settling things otherwise works out a lot better for faculty than it does for students.
Michael, how do you pronounce it? Wojcik,
right.
Signed a statement in regard to educational planning.
Over there, the soft person, you push in a little bit here, but that isn't really what you wanted anyway. Globally, nothing's accomplished.
Of course, the contractor gets rid of the soft person, doesn't it? I mean, that has
that's one of the points of it, is to make some things be settled in a hard fashion. It's one of the reasons why faculty members today would by and large be very happy to hear the TA had gone away and the contract had gone away and that nothing had to be settled in a hard fashion anymore. Because settling things otherwise works out a lot better for faculty than it does for students.
Michael, how do you pronounce it? Wojcik,
right.
Signed a statement in regard to educational planning. Was he one of your group?
Mike certainly would not have been a group. I don't think he was worried about student power. I think he would have been a group who fitted in much more with, it's always nice to talk to the students. Let's do some more of it. And let's see.
That would be the United faculty too, wouldn't it, on the whole?
Yeah, well, United faculty, actually at the time, I was a member of United faculty.
Oh, were you?
And this, of course, was a very testing time for them, because they certainly wanted to be good union members altogether. And they certainly figured that if TAs can do it today, that ought to enhance our chances of doing it tomorrow. And yet TAs were really digging in there on student power issues in a way which made it difficult for United faculty to just say, right on, we're behind TAA all the way. And so there was a lot of unhappy meetings in the United faculty during that period. And actually, I finally quit United faculty essentially on that issue.
You should almost think you'd have had to. Certainly none of the TAs have had a kind word to say about United faculty.
United faculty has wound up both then and just this year very much worse off than if there hadn't been a TAA on campus. They've lost both ways. You know, they haven't made the TAs happy, and yet they haven't been able to just throw them over and pursue things from a point of view which would appeal to the most faculty. And back in 70, they finally went for a statement which said, roughly speaking, we wholeheartedly endorse those good things which TA is asking for, with a design to tell some people that the things TA was asking for were good things, and to tell other people, you know, that we aren't endorsing only all of what TA wants, but only those things which are good. But that wasn't good enough for me.
Was this this gave rise to factions in United faculty, and was it because of whoever was the leader then, I don't know who it was, that it went one way rather than the other? Or was it an unresolvable position?
It was, I think, you know, practically speaking, unresolvable. I mean, United faculty also had its own problems in addition to TA at that time, may still, but at that time they were terribly involved with the question about tenured versus non-tenured faculty. And should there not be a non-tenured faculty caucus which would have sole power to set United Faculty policy on all matters relating to non-tenured faculty on the grounds that tenured faculty couldn't be trusted to do this. And that was a much worse one for them than the TA thing in a way, because it was even more central to faculty types, who after all, you know, that's who's most important to United Faculty. And they got too deeply trapped in their liberalism and finally bought at least a pretty substantial version of the non-tenured caucus. And it was just dumb. I think they lost both with tenured faculty and with non-tenured faculty. Because, you know, what the liberal tenured faculty couldn't see was that quite as acutely as the non-tenured faculty could, that the non-tenured faculty really needed the tenured faculty. And, it was intrinsic in the whole situation. They had to be prepared to pay a good deal for that, particularly, you know, to hope that, you know, to let all questions go to a vote of all United faculty and nail down the tenured portion of United faculty to those decisions just as much as everybody else, and then hope that they could win, you know, something reasonable in United faculty, whereas, you know, the way it's was set up with a non-tenured faculty caucus made it as easy as pie for the tenured types of United faculty. Once that caucus decides something, shrug their shoulders and say, I had no vote, it wasn't my decision. I'm not going to do anything about it. You know, let it be printed as a matter of United Faculty policy and forgotten. And I think the non-tenured people, many of them, saw that that was, you know, what this was going to produce. They were in a little bit of an emotional bind. If the tenured types weren't going to put this point of view forward, it was hard for the non-tenured types to put it forward. But there were a long series of meetings, and attendance dropped, and people felt bluer and bluer and more, you know, that this union is never, on the basis of this year's meetings, going to amount to anything. So that was going on, maybe immediately preceding the TA business. That was, I thought, a tougher one for United Faculty to deal with than the TA one. The TA one was tough. The United Faculty types, of course, were not representative, didn't include the full spectrum of faculty, and didn't find even the student, you know, once they had confronted the student power issue, which they did much more seriously than the faculty as a whole, because they were in that kind of business, it made them uncomfortable, but it didn't make them as uncomfortable as it would have made the whole faculty, because they were found it easier to believe that if the students got something, it could all be taken from the administration. And United Faculty types tend, on the whole, to be pretty dubious about the bona fides of the administration. And A, tend to see the administration as a separate entity more sharply than the average faculty member does, and B, to be doubtful about the administration more than the average faculty.
You think that's true even now?
I never went back to United Faculty.
No, I was just wondering if the faculty now wasn't more inclined to think of the administration as something separate from itself than it might have been then.
Yeah, but not terribly significantly so.
Okay.
So, let's see, back to summer of 69. I forget whether I was involved in bargaining that summer or not. Ergo, I have nothing much to say about summer of 69. Certainly in the fall of 69, the existence of TAA began to be evident every day in Van Vleck. the word was coming back from both sides of the bargaining table, these sessions are most unsatisfactory and don't quite see any easy and happy resolution. GAA was certainly working to increase membership and to raise consciousness among TAs, and was working also to bring their point of view to the faculty.
Did they have office space and places where they could meet here at that time?
No, we certainly never made any office space available to them as GAA.
So whatever they did was visible, it had, presumably it had.
Well, I don't know. I don't imagine they used office space in that lecturing. If they wanted to hold meetings, that's something they did do here from time to time. And they would come along and ask, could we hold a meeting in this or that room?
Did you have a faculty lounge?
Yeah.
Was it confined to faculty?
No, it's faculty. In theory, it's for faculty and graduate students, and in practice, it's usually for, I mean, you know, the odd person or two wandering in there is not going to get asked, who are you?
But it wasn't something restricted to faculty.
That's correct. But when TA would hold his meetings, they'd usually use a classroom somewhere.
Was that ever an issue, that there should have been a lounge that only the faculty could use?
No. Actually, when the building was set up, the lounge was separately funded. It was not built as part of the main building costs. It was built by the National Science Foundation. And the rationale was that it was to be a place for faculty to meet with, I think the words were, graduate students pursuing research.
Uh-huh.
And indeed, there may have been some thought at that time it was not going to be a lounge for everybody graduate student, but only for the ones who were a bit further along. But I don't believe that, you know, whatever may have been in the minds of the guy who wrote the proposal, I don't think anything ever came of any distinctions among graduate students.
In practice, every graduate student felt free to go
there. Yeah. Yeah.
And did faculty and graduate students actually meet and talk there?
Oh, yeah. Again, from that day to this. People who feel like a bit of sociability and a cup of coffee just zip up to the ninth floor and do indeed talk informally, typically in mixed groups of faculty and graduate students. And that was the case then, and that's where, on issues like TAA, most all the faculty to graduate students and vice versa conversation would have gone on. And I suppose if you had complete tape recordings of everything that was said in that lounge, it would be very pointless talking to me. You'd have the whole transaction right there, as regards, you know, faculty talking to TAs, TAs talking to faculty.
Maybe we should set one up now.
Right. We did have a couple of meetings for faculty to be informed about TAA, such as this one that Marquette came to. I'm sure that was a meeting which was designed to be for faculty as well as graduate students.
It must have a huge room if you have a place where all the faculty and graduate students potentially could get together.
Well, they couldn't all get together if they all wanted to go at once, but it's a fair-sized room. It would, the only places for maybe, the only places to sit down for maybe 50 people, 60 people, something like that. If you drag in chairs and sit on the floor, you could, I suppose, push up toward 200. I don't think we ever had quite that much of a crowd. Marchetti certainly talked in the lounge, and we must have dragged in chairs. Purpose.
That was well attended, was it?
My very vague recollection is that we would have had something like 100 people there, also. And So during that whole fall, there was a lot of discussion about how bargaining was going, about what this might all mean to us.
Excuse me, interrupt again. Do you know what percentage of your TAs eventually became members of the TAA?
I feel bad about answering that question because at that time I certainly must have known how many were on dues checkoff. Now I don't know. I would guess roughly two-thirds, maybe a bit higher than two-thirds, somewhere between 67 and 80%.
Carry on.
That's an all-time high. We certainly did pay attention at that time to how many people, the university could tell us how many people were having dues check off.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only way to really get data on that. And, I suppose we could have asked TA leaders, but it never seemed that that would be terribly fruitful. There was certainly a great deal of interest among graduates, among TAs and TAA, and again, I'm sure there were 5% of the graduate students who said a union has no place on campus, or 5% of TAs even, who said a union of TAs has no place on campus. And a few of those would have been people who said, unions have no place in the world, and a few more would have been those who said unions are fine. A rather larger group would have said unions are fine for other people, but they aren't right for, for people like me, or people in my situation. But then these would have been, certainly couldn't have amounted to as many as 10% of the TAs as a whole. On the other end of the scale, we're certainly more than 10%, and maybe 25% of the TAs who really worked quite hard at TAA and thought, this is really an important thing. Must at times have felt that this was as important a part of their lives at that point as anything else they were doing, maybe more important. So, again, I really don't know just how they put it, but it must have assumed at least equal importance to other things. And then in the middle of the group of TAs, somewhat less actively involved, but thinking this union should be a good thing for me, or maybe a good thing for me, or it's is the right thing for, the appropriate thing for a person in my situation to be doing this year. There's a lot of that. My point of view, that's, herd think or something like that, when somebody, different than, not in my reference group is doing it, and, presumably when I'm doing it myself, I'm not conscious of it. It's group think, when something we're always conscious of in other groups, not our own group. Let's see. As I say, TAs were, in our department were telling us, number one, things aren't bad in the math department. This is not, although TAA is indeed taking, hostile stance. I'm sure they didn't use the word hostile stance, but used, something like that.
Tough
stance toward the university as a whole. This is certainly not directed against the math department. It is necessary because of bad conditions in other departments. Two, as a matter of fact, all that we are asking is really that essentially that things be on the whole, for the whole campus, as they are in the math departments. With perhaps a few changes in detail, but really what we were asking is serious part of what we were asking is no different, would not represent a real change for the math department. And what else are they saying? Presumably they were saying other things like, you know, look at how little money we get and how you'll have to admit that we're are more in need of the protections of the union than you guys who have tenure and fat salaries and all the rest of it. Fourthly, that I got up to four, the real problem is the wickedness of the administration. They're not bargaining in good faith, they're a tricky bunch of guys, they don't want to make any progress, they are trying to set us against one another. And there is, you know, the root of the problems, and what we really should be doing is joining with faculty who also have their problems vis-a-vis the administration and presenting a common front.
Really? I hadn't heard this point of view described.
Yeah. I don't know that that was ever part of any leaflet that was handed out, but it was certainly made from time to time explicitly in talks and conversations, and certainly the kind of argument which said, well, now look, you know, how do you guys, you know, fair in getting what you want from the administration, don't we? You know, are you entirely happy with that? Or conversely, well, look, why don't we go and ask the administration? You say that you personally have no objection to our having this, whatever this may be, something that we kids want. So why don't we go together and ask the administration for it? So that, you know.
That did you respond to that?
This sort of thing came up primarily in not in the context where